This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Moms, dads, are you the parent of a student athlete? Do you want to know how to get the most out of youth sports? If so, listen to the Next Pitch podcast to give you the tools to raise an aspiring athlete. It's not simple, but we talk straight and give you the best insight there is when it comes to youth sports. We'll cover everything from nutrition and training to mental toughness and teamwork. It's a podcast you can listen to together with your kids so everyone can benefit. Follow Next Pitch on the Odyssey app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. Israel's security cabinet on Sunday approved a plan to invade and occupy the Gaza Strip in what is being called an expanded ground operation. The plan is named Operation Gideon's Chariot. And Israelis are saying this mobilization is reportedly going to be one of the largest since the war began in October of 2023. And yes, they are using the word occupy. They are saying that they are finally going to occupy the Gaza Strip. Whatever land that they have, they will not give back. And they intend to keep. Joining us to talk about this is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, senior fellow and military expert with Defense Priorities. Lieutenant Colonel, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So, Lieutenant Colonel, I guess it's fair to say this is a major shift in what they are saying and what their belief is about the next steps for them in this operation.
Well, it is definitely a big change because, you know, the Trump administration, since even before it came in, they had been working with the Netanyahu government to try to get a ceasefire, to try to get all their hostages back, to end the bloodshed, et cetera. You know, the original plan ceasefire was supposed to be a multi-phase, I think a three-phase operation that would end up over a slope, a long period of time or a medium period of time, number of weeks, would get all the hostages back in exchange for Palestinians to get some of their prisoners back from the Israeli side, et cetera. And then it was going to lead to a negotiated complete end to the war. And now then it's gone the exact reverse. After getting, you know, part of the first phase applied or executed, and they got some of the hostages back, then Israel said, well, now the Hamas side is backtracking on some of these things. So they said, now we're just going to go in. So all that had been accomplished there has now been ruined, frankly. And now here they're going to go back in on the ground. At the same time, they're also basically expanding the war to Yemen. They've been in Israel even today has launched some additional strikes into a port facility and an airport in Yemen. And of course, that doesn't have any indication it's going to be over anytime soon. And you have to ask the question, has Israel bitten off more than it can militarily chew? Because I frankly don't know what the attainable military objective is for Israel in this going back into the Gaza Strip. Because, I mean, they didn't finish the job in 19 months in the first iteration. So I'm not sure why they think they're going to succeed this time.
So this is the outcome, what they have announced the other day. Your best guess, why now?
You know, that's one of the big questions here. Other than, you know, that many people have suggested that Israel never wanted peace in the first place. They didn't want the ceasefire in the first place because they don't want to negotiate an end. They want an outright military victory. And if that is the case, I think they're going to be sorely disappointed. And listen, part of the reason why the Israel side needed that ceasefire was because they were wearing out their reserve forces. Their system of military is not designed for long-term campaigns that extend into extended periods of time. They're made for short, sharp wars of decision, and then the reserve forces will go back home. These people were already refusing to show up to duty in larger numbers because it was ruining their lives. Now that they've specifically relied on tens of thousands of more reserve soldiers to be called up for this, and the government is openly saying that this is probably going to be a multi-month situation. They don't even think it's going to end soon, but I just don't understand where the likelihood of success is going to come when the fundamentals that caused them to basically get worn out the first time are still in effect. So this, frankly, is just kind of puzzling across the board.
In your mind, how would you characterize or identify or decide we've reached success in the elimination of Hamas? What would that look like? Because I have a little,
you know, listen, I
understand a little, I guess, I mean, not like you, but I understand a little of what's going on, but I'm having a real difficult time understanding what does success look like?
Listen, I'm telling you as straightforward as I can, Israel lost the chance to have success in the first couple of months of this war. I said early on, and now it is playing out exactly that way, that they are pursuing a course of action that cannot succeed militarily, and in fact is laying deep seeds of future instability for their own country. Because when you have killed so many innocent people and literally raised the ground, the ability of the entire strip for 2 million people even to survive and to live in anything other than an existent state, you are guaranteeing that the anger built up inside those, once this fighting stops, and the fighting always stops at some point, but the resentment built up here is going to cause the same fundamentals that led to October 7th in the first place to just be on steroids. So even if you somehow manage to kill literally every single member of Hamas, all of the rest of the male population, especially of all those who have lost children, and there's 30,000 children that have been killed in all of this carnage so far, I mean, they're not going to just lay down and be passive. They're going to look for an opportunity in the future. They're going to buy their time, et cetera. That's why I say these are seeds that are buried deep, and Israel is – I don't know how they're going to undo this for now. So if anybody thinks there's going to be a victory here, there could be a temporary one, but it is going to be a Pyrrhic victory.
I mean, I guess the only way, you correct me if I'm wrong, is to statistically speaking, to have success is to go in and occupy in a permanent fashion and not even recognize it any longer, right?
Well, no, I mean, that's a band-aid.
I mean, you're going to be in conflict forever, but, you know, I mean, I guess it's just something that you decide on. Do I want to be in conflict forever? I don't know how heated it's going to be, and just go in and occupy it and take it over and call it a day.
Well, see, look, let's be blunt. Here's your options. You either go in and kill everyone or get them physically out and drive them wherever. I don't even know where in the world you could possibly send that many people. Or you're going to have to change your policies to recognize the existence of these people and find some way to possibly live together. Because if you don't, then you are building in long-term instability for Israel. I mean, the terrorist threat will remain because that's the only tool left to people when you put them in a situation like what the Palestinian people is. I know that's not a popular thing to hear, but that's what the Israelis have done for themselves right now. That's where they are.
And they've actually been there for a long, long time. And the opportunities given to the Arab nations to help or facilitate or provide sustenance here, I think Syria has backwalked on their agreement to take 2,000 or 3,000 of the orphan children into Syria. I think they've reneged on that deal. Or Jordan. It may be Jordan, excuse me. I think it's Jordan. Correct?
I have not heard that part. It could well be accurate. But, I mean, that's again, that's not even a Band-Aid. That's such a small number. You're talking 2 million people.
I'm just talking like figuratively, you know, these small wins that you could get to help the population, it's not happening. No one in the region is really stepping up.
Well, because what they're being asked to step up to is something that they find fundamentally unacceptable. They're basically being asked to participate in the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, and they say they're not going to do that, and the Palestinian people themselves say they don't want to. I'm sure that some number would leave if they had the chance, just to have some kind of chance to have a life. But it's clear that large numbers have staked it out. They say this is the land that we were born in. Our ancestors lived here. And for them, it's an existential issue that they're just not going to give up on. And as long as that's the case, you have basically two immovable objects on both the Israeli and the Hamas side, or the Palestinian side, rather. And unless the Israeli side is willing to do something different, There's no alternative left for the Palestinian people. That's the big point we need to understand.
Have we had any kind of similar friction points like this with two separate populations in a country fighting? I think there's been some in Africa, you may know better than I, that have ever we've achieved successful conclusion to this kind of conflict?
There certainly have been in times, like the Armenian Azerbaijan. I mean, that's still kind of rolling to this day. You certainly had the Houthis and the Tutsis in Africa, among others. And what has to happen is that the one or both sides finally have to burn down until they no longer can continue to resist, or they no longer can continue to keep up. If you're the more powerful side, like the Israelis are, they finally just get worn down and they say, this is just not worth it. But we're nowhere near that right now. So this has no end in sight. It will eventually burn out, because all conflicts do, but the carnage between now and then could just be catastrophic.
Yeah. I mean, I know that you got military experts like to look at history militarily, how these things kind of play themselves out. And I was kind of curious, has one ever reached a level of success, of what we would say success might be here? I couldn't think of any, and that's why I was kind of curious if there were any. Let us...
None that is certainly a model to go to. I mean, just to having a forest fire burn itself out, of course, leaves the forest destroyed, and then it takes, you know, generations to rebuild, even on top of that. And that's why I was saying from the beginning of this war that Israel needed to change its course and for the first time since 1947, find some way to give the Palestinian people even a reason to hope. Because if you don't have both sides of this have some plausible reason to tell their people there's a reason to hope in the future, you will guarantee neither side has peace or security going forward. That's the harsh truth.
Let's pivot real quick. Let's talk about Iran. And, you know, it seems to me that the Houthis in sending bombs into Israel almost nightly is really stoking the fire and not making the Gazan or the issue with Hezbollah in the north any easier, right?
Well, I mean, that depends on your perspective, because I actually had a guest on my show yesterday, the Daniel Davis Deep Dive, who said, listen, we need to understand that everybody doesn't fight the way we do, and they don't use the same calculations. He said, for example, many of these groups in the Middle East, they don't count victory as defeating the enemy militarily. They count victory as not losing. And so you see that in the Houthis. They've been doing this since 2015 with the Saudi Arabians, had been trying to bomb them into the Stone Age. They never succeeded. And this isn't going to succeed either. It's very unlikely that now, all of a sudden, with both the U.S. and Israel pummeling different parts of the Houthis in Yemen, that suddenly they're just going to lay down now. I think that you're going to find that this is a generational struggle, just like we saw in North Vietnam. They were willing to pay millions of casualties and go on until we finally got tired. I think that you'll see a similar thing here. So if anybody expects it to change, they're going to keep fighting.
So is that to say that we can just assume that the Middle East for decades and centuries to come is going to continue to be unsettled?
Unless the Israeli side decides they want to change their policies. They are the ones that have the dominant military power. So they are the ones that can change this. Because remember, the whole thing with the Houthis, they didn't start doing this until the Israeli side invaded into the Gaza Strip in the first place last year in 2023. And they said that if you'll stop that and you'll withdraw, so will we. We'll stop these attacks. When there was a ceasefire, they were good to their word, and they stopped the attacks in the Red Sea. It was only when Israel went back in and started attacking that they said, all right, that's it. You're cutting off the food. Now we're going back to it. If you want that to stop, then the Israeli war can stop, and so will that. So it is tied to what the Israeli side chooses to do.
It's just kind of interesting to see how this is going to ultimately play out. I mean, I think all roads lead back to Iran at some point in time. I know there's been talk amongst the Israeli parliament as to whether or not they go after their nuclear capabilities and eliminate that possibility there for decades to come, so that they're not having to face that, whatever the next challenge may be. And it just seems that just becomes a whole nother friction point, right?
Well, it is, and it's even worse. I mean, when you're talking, Israel's already on the verge of being overstretched, as I mentioned earlier in your show here, by going into the Yemen situation, by still doing things periodically in both Syria and in Lebanon. Obviously, the situation in both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And if you want to add the Iranians into it, I mean, that could literally lead to the defeat of Israel. You can't have that many enemies and think you can beat everybody. And listen, the big thing, the warning bell I keep hitting with a gong every time somebody mentions this, think about what happens next. You go in there with a bombing run and you blow up a bunch of stuff in Iran, you hit nuclear facilities or whatever, then what? What are you going to do next? And you know, you have Naftali Bennett, who is constantly saying this is a once-in-a-50-year opportunity to regime change. Well, if you don't bomb the regime to death, and you won't, then what? What do you do next? And even if you did somehow miraculously get all of the leadership, then what do you have next? Do you think that there's going to be the people who live there are going to suddenly go yay for Israel and let's live in peace? Of course not. They're not going to do that. You're going to make the matter worse. And by the way, Israel or Iran, unlike these other appendages and proxy groups, they have the capacity to strike hard against U.S. assets in the area, American personnel, other oil facilities. I mean, they can make the place a living hell if they think that they're facing an existential crisis. Don't unleash that. Don't put them into a corner to where the only thing they have is to burn the place down because they can.
Yeah. I watched your podcast last evening, if you don't mind me just pivoting real quick to Ukraine. I found it really interesting. And there were a lot of things that you brought to the forefront for me that I didn't really wrap my head around. How much is the Ukrainian situation consuming these military assets that for even the allies of Israel to be in a position to actually share more with them when a lot of folks are sharing with both and everybody's kind of taxed? Would that be an overstatement?
Right now, people are starting to get tapped out. I assure you, I have some sources at the British Ministry of Defense. It said many of their key inventories of their own national defense weapon systems and ammunition categories are depleted, to use his word. They're scrambling trying to get that done, but they just don't. And that's the UK, and you know, and they have more capacity to produce weapons than nearly anybody else in Europe. So you can imagine other countries just don't have the capacity to maintain the stuff and keep their own inventories going in. And if you're talking about Israel now re-expanding the Gaza war, so they're already saying here's more months, where so now then their ammunition needs are going to go through the roof. Somebody's going to have to provide that because they can't do it for themselves. And now that you have Zelensky saying he doesn't want to have a deal with Russia, he wants to keep fighting. He keeps asking for more weapons, more air defense systems, more ammunition, more money, etc. He doesn't want to have a negotiated settlement that they lose their territory. You know, you can understand his desire, but if there isn't the capacity to stop the Russians, then why would it make any sense for any Western country to say, we're going to keep giving you more and more ammunition that hasn't worked in the fourth year of war? Why do you think it's going to work now? And it's just a net loss. And look, math is going to play a part at some point. And you can't have the Ukraine side continue to fight, the Israeli side expanding this into the Gaza, maybe even into Iran. There's just not enough ammunition to go around. Something's got to give.
Yeah, I mean, I know that you get criticized a lot because you lay out kind of, you know, the facts, the unpleasant truths. I'll put it that way. About military capability, about the readiness of the military, as well as assets, you know, the bullets, the bombs, the missiles, the this, the that there's an end to that. And your consumption rate, and I guess what we're experiencing right now between these two conflicts, our consumption rate is not something that the EU, NATO, UK, USA can afford to keep funding. Is that fair?
Well, they can't. And yeah, I certainly do take a lot of criticism for that, but I push right back because I'm just saying, you know, I'm not against anybody on our side. In fact, I'm for Israel. I'm for the United States. I'm for Europe. But I'm saying, fellas, reality counts. and it matters. You can have this fiction and this, what I call this made-for-TV script writing out of Hollywood of the ending you'd like to have, and that's fine. You can have your preferences. But when it comes to the hardcore truth and reality on the ground in your own defensive inventories against what you see on the other side, and Russia is through the roof, even according to our own General Cavoli, the head of Europe's U.S. European Command, in testimony last month, he said they're able to outproduce in every category, three times in the artillery shell, the capacity. It's off the charts with armored vehicles, infantry fighting vehicles, tanks, et cetera. All of the key things that you need to wage a war, the Ukraine side and the entire Western side can't match what the Russians can do. So it's a math problem. And it doesn't matter how much you don't like math. The numbers are what they are, and they're going to eventually bite you. Don't wait until they've sunk their teeth into you before you finally give into it. Make a wise choice now while we still have lunch options.
Lieutenant Colonel, last question, and this is going to sound like an ignorant question. At the risk of sounding ignorant, I'm going to say it because a lot of this mystifies me. But are the Russians just more willing to accept casualties than we are? I mean, they're losing
Russia
a lot of people.
Russia considers this an existential fight, and they will put whatever cost it takes to secure themselves as they see their Western security, and they will pay whatever price it does. But they have millions more men to pay that price than the Ukraine side does.
And I guess the public there, a certain percentage of them just have this blind faith and trust in Putin, and all things are going to be good. I mean, their pain threshold is obviously much different than the U.S., right?
It is. But see, from the Russian side, they say this is an existential fight. It's the entire West. It's NATO against them, and openly so. It's not just against Ukraine. And they like, if we don't win this war, our very nation could be at risk. And so they say you're coming after us economically, militarily, diplomatically. It's a full-on war for them. So they are willing to pay any price. And they have the capacity to win this on the ground if it goes long enough.
Folks, if you want to hear great conversations, you want to go to Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis's website, and they can find out where, Lieutenant Colonel?
Daniel Davis Deep Dive on YouTube. Just Google that, and it'll take you right there.
Daniel Davis Deep Dive. He gets some great guests, robust conversations, both sides of the issue. I love the debates. It's just a great conversation, and it's really a learning experience. It has been for me. Thank you so much, Lieutenant Colonel, for joining us today. Appreciate your time, your insight, and have a great week.
You bet. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.